Good evening, and thank you for coming. Welcome to the 2014 Dominicans Fall Leadership Lecture Series. We're in partnership with Book Passage Marin in San Francisco, our very own independent bookstore. My name, yes, I agree. Thanks. My name is Joan Capurro, and I'm a member of the Board of Dominicans Women in Leadership and Philanthropy Council. It's my honor to welcome you to Dominican University of California and to encourage the women to join WLPC. This lecture series is a program of Dominicans Institute for Leadership Studies, a center for leadership development, offering education and training for students and professionals to become better leaders. The Institute and Book Passage host this public forum to engage students, the campus, the community, in socially relevant discussions and highlight inspired acts of leadership across the disciplines. This live performance also will be aired on Dominican's website at dominican.edu/leadership, podcast on Dominican Penguin Radio, and aired on Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Channel 30 Public TV. Our lead sponsor for the Leadership Lecture Series is Private Ocean, a personal and powerful wealth management, one of the oldest and the largest privately held wealth management firms in Marin, and they are wonderful, by the way, named 7 times by Worth Magazine as one of the top 100 registered investment advisors nationwide, and 2013 Best Wealth Management Firm by North Bay Biz. Private Ocean's teams committed to community engagement, as it's witnessed here, the season with their fourth year at the Leadership Lecture Series lead sponsor. Thank you, Private Ocean Wealth Management, for continuing to help bring our community together. Additional sponsors for tonight's event. Tonight's program has 2 additional sponsors for women's organizations whose mission linked to Senator Gillibrand's lecture for tonight. Thank you to Dominican Women's Leadership and Philanthropy Council, WLPC. Not me alone, there's 60 or 70 of us, made up of Dominican women and members of the community at large, focused on developing women as philanthropic leaders. We advocate the balanced representation of women in leadership and philanthropic roles to impact positive change in ourselves, organizations, and society. We model and teach philanthropic, collaborative, and inclusive leadership, as well as coach and mentor upcoming generations to become philanthropic leaders. Others will follow. As a member of WLPC, I'm pleased to represent other members in our sponsorship of tonight's lecture. Also, Marin Women's Commission, raise your hands if you're here. I know some of you are, Cecilia, okay. Returns often to support a leadership lecture that matches the mission and values. The Institute for Leadership Studies is celebrating its 10th year in partnership with the Marin Women's Commission, guided by the mutual commitment that women's leadership effectively impacts systems change so that women of all ages are empowered, educated, and engaged in community. Thank you, Marin Women's Commission, for your sponsorship. It's my pleasure now to introduce President Mary Marcy, who will introduce Senator Gillibrand. And I want to say something about you. Also, one more thing I want to say about you that's not in the script, but she was also the Spirit of Marin honoree chosen by the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce for her work in this community and in this university. Thank you.
Thank you, Joan. I didn't know that was coming, obviously. And we're very grateful to Joan Capurro and her career and decades of service in Marin and her leadership as a founding member of the Women's Leadership Philanthropy Council here at Dominican. But I get the distinct privilege of welcoming our special guest this evening, United States Senator Kirsten Gillibrand from New York. It's an honor in a couple of ways, and one is one that I want to share with you from my own personal experience. Many of you know that before I came to Dominican, I was working in the Bard College system, and Bard College is actually in New York State. So I have this sense of having watched the senator before she was a senator, and I want to share with you a couple of the things that I learned from that experience. The first thing I learned is that you should never underestimate Kirsten Gillibrand, and people do it all the time. So when I was watching her political career begin, she was running in a fairly conservative seat as a Democrat for the House. No one thought she would win. She won. Then when Hillary Rodham Clinton stepped down to become Secretary of State, she was appointed to the U.S. Senate, and no one thought she could win the seat in her own right. And she won it against some very high-profile names. But it's not just that she won, and it's not just that she was underestimated. In 2012, in the last election cycle, she was actually elected to her first full six-year Senate term with 72% of the vote and 60 of 62 counties in New York State, still a New York State record. So don't underestimate Kirsten Gillibrand. I'm not sure how anyone can anymore if you actually look at her background. She worked as an attorney in New York City for nearly a decade, served as special counsel to Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Andrew Cuomo under the Clinton administration, and earlier this year was named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world. The second thing I want you to know about Senator Gillibrand, from a very personal perspective again, is that she is an absolute champion of education. She's a working mother of two boys, and she believes a good education is a foundation for their success and for the success of all of our children. But it's more than a belief. She puts it into action. She co-sponsored the Pathways to College Act, designed to increase the number of students from low-income families who attend college. She authored the Roosevelt Scholars Act to attract more experts in high-tech fields to careers in public service. She sponsored the College Affordability Tax Relief Act to allow families to deduct up to $10,000 of the cost of college tuition from their taxes. And she has increased the amount of Pell Grant scholarships for nearly 70,000 New York State students. And finally, Senator Gillibrand is a strong voice and role model for women. Two people, she says, changed her own career in this regard: her mother, who she calls the queen of multitasking, and Hillary Rodham Clinton, who I'm hoping we'll hear some stories about tonight. Secretary Clinton inspired Kirsten with a speech she made in China. And when the senator, not yet senator, asked how she could get involved, Secretary Clinton said she could host a political fundraiser for her. She did. And that started to change her career. Her book is entitled Off the Sidelines. It is both a memoir and a call to action. She appeals to women to become politically involved, to raise our voices, to make a difference in our communities and our world. Hillary Rodham Clinton was appointed Secretary of State in 2009, and in filling Clinton's New York State Senate seat, Senator Gillibrand has established herself as a passionate, fearless, and effective presence in Congress for all of us, not just for the citizens of New York State. She's going to be joined on our stage by our dear friend and great collaborator from Book Passage, Elaine Petrocelli, who will interview her. So please join me in welcoming Senator Gillibrand and Elaine Petrocelli.
I'm really excited. Thank you so much for being here. I have so many questions that we could talk all night, but I know you have a plane to catch. So I think we'll talk for about 20, 25 minutes, and then let's invite our audience to ask questions. And then afterwards, we'll get everyone's book signed, and so that there's time to meet everyone. We're not going to be personalizing books, so I hope everyone will understand.
Unless you have a daughter or a niece that desperately needs a book at age 10.
Right, or your
I will do that for you.
How can you refuse?
Exactly.
I'd like to start with the title of the book, Senator Gillibrand, Off the Sidelines, Raise Your Voice, Change the World. That's a great title. Could you just talk about how you came up with that?
Well, the whole book is really about the importance of women's voices, that women's life experience is very different, and our perspectives on almost anything is different. And if we can be heard on the thing we care most about, it will change outcomes. It can change the world. And I tell story after story about young women who raised their voices, came to me, whether telling me a horrible story about being assaulted on a college campus, and instead of just sitting back and doing nothing, they started a movement and went college to college asking for reforms. It's all about women's voices and how much of a difference we can make. And I want to create this conversation and this call to action to tell women how important they are.
Well, you definitely do it. One of the things that struck me are the strong women in your own life, your mother, your grandmother, and other women. Could you talk a little, I would love to know more about your grandmother, especially.
Sure. So I grew up with some really amazing role models, which really formed who I am. It's not surprising I am who I am because of my mother and my grandmother. My grandmother was raised in the south end of Albany. She came from a family of very little means. She never went to college. She worked her whole life. And she was very salty. She was a bit of a sailor in terms of her language. And she was a secretary in our state legislature, and she recognized 75 years ago that women had such little power. They didn't have a voice in government, and their roles were relegated to support. There were very few women elected. And so she believed that her voice mattered, and she believed that women's voices mattered. So what she did was she asked women to participate, and she was able to amplify her voice by making sure other women's voices were heard. And together they created grassroots networks of women who cared about politics. And they did all the grassroots organizing, whether it was door-to-door, envelope stuffing, or phone banking. And I just remember going into these campaign headquarters when I was a little girl and seeing these tables of ladies just stuffing envelopes and smiling and laughing and feeling so engaged and involved and thinking that was something amazing. And so I always aspired, because of her, to do something in public life, something in politics. I didn't know how and I didn't know when, but because of her, when I was asked as a 6 or 7 year old, what do you want to be when you grow up? I said I wanted to be a senator. I didn't know what a senator was, but it sounded important and it sounded like somebody who could make a difference. But one of my own challenges, which I share in the book, is I really lost that girlhood bravado. I really was afraid to admit that I wanted to do public service later on. And I had to eventually own my own ambitions and be who I am. My mother taught me the very simple lesson that you should be exactly who you are. She was a woman who loved being a hands-on mom. She made the most beautiful dresses we had when we were little. She loved baking, she loved cooking, but she also was only one of three women in her law school class. And so she was one of the few moms who worked outside the home in a professional capacity. So she was really a role model for all my friends. And I just remember her being in the kitchen, and that's when phones had cords, and our cord stretched very far. She'd be stretching the cord off the wall and talking about an adoption case while she's cooking dinner, while she's sweeping the floor, while she's saying, "Hi, honey, how was your day?" And I just remember that she created a world that was consistent with what she wanted and her values. She also, by the time she was my age, had a second degree black belt in karate. So she was a very different kind of mom.
You might be able to use that in the Senate.
Yeah.
I was fascinated by the fact that you went to law school, like your mom, and then became an attorney in a very prestigious firm, Davis Polk, and were probably making some very nice money. And I, since my son used to work there, I know that you worked 100 hours a day.
Pretty much.
But how did you one day decide, I'm going to leave this and get involved in politics, and then you end up in HUD, which I doubt pays what no. Davis Polk pays.
Yes, all true. So I had this aha moment, this bit of awakening, and it was when I was a young lawyer at Davis Polk, working endless hours, weekends, nights, constantly. And I noticed that Hillary Clinton, our then First Lady, went to China. The reason why I noticed was because I had been an Asian studies major at Dartmouth, I'd learned Mandarin, and I'd studied in the dorms in Beijing. And she was on a stage in Beijing making these very powerful pronouncements about women's rights. Women's rights were human rights, and human rights were women's rights. In a country that really didn't have a women's rights movement, and it was powerful. And what I was most upset about is that I didn't know about the conference, and I wasn't invited. And I realized at that moment that I would have only been invited if I was involved in politics. And so that sort of woke me up to this conversation happening around the world, around our country, that I really wasn't part of. So I called a friend whose mom was very involved and asked her how to get involved in New York City, because I didn't know much about New York City politics. And she said, join this women's group. It's called the Women's Leadership Forum. So I called the lady in charge, and she said, oh, we'd love to have you join. You just have to write a check. It's a check for $1,000. I thought, $1,000? That's a lot of money. And I was young, and the only check that size I wrote was my rent check. So I decided to write it anyway, because it was the only advice I'd been given. And I went to my first event. And my first event was an event that Hillary Clinton was attending, and she was our honorary chair. And she speaks out to a group like this, and I'm standing in the back, and she looks out, and she says, decisions are being made every day in Washington, and if you're not part of those decisions and you don't like what they decide, you have no one to blame but yourself. And I feel like she's talking directly to me. And so I'm standing in the back of the room getting very sweaty and feeling very uncomfortable and feeling that she's saying, I have to run for office. I'm not ready. I'm afraid. But it was that wake-up call. It was that aha moment that I really did have something inside me that wanted to do public service, and I didn't know how to get from A to B. And that's really what started my journey on trying to leave my big fancy law firm with my very high-paying job to do public service. And, you know, for younger women in the audience, it is not clear how you get from A to B. I first tried to work at the U.S. Attorney's Office, and I did not get the job. I applied to the Eastern and Southern District, didn't get the jobs. Then I said, well, I'll go the charity route, and I applied to the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Corporation, and the Rockefeller Foundation. I don't even get an interview. And then Hillary Clinton decides to run for Senate. I think, oh, this is my big shot. I'm totally going to work on her campaign. I try to get a full-time position, but I don't have the right experience. And so this is when I meet Andrew Cuomo. I go to another one of my WLF events, and Andrew's the speaker. And he gets up and he talks about why public service is so important and why being a Democrat matters and why you have to serve others. And by this point, it's almost 2 years. I can't find my way from A to B. So I storm up to him and I say, Mr. Secretary, I loved your speech, but I really think politics is an insider's game, and I don't know how to get there. And so if you know anything about our governor, he's very provocative. So he says, what do you do? And I say, I'm a lawyer, seventh year associate at Davis Polk. And he says, well, would you move to Washington? Now, for a young single girl in New York City, you really don't ever want to move to Washington. But I wasn't going to leave it there, so I said, of course I'd move to Washington. And sure enough, I get invited to go down and interview, and I get the job. And I go home that night, and I talk a little bit about this in the book, too, which I think is relevant for everyone here. It's really helpful to have a partner in life, somebody who shares your values and encourages you and knows you well. And that person for me has always been my husband, then boyfriend. So I go home that night to talk to Jonathan, and he says, oh, Kirsten, since I've known you, all you've ever wanted to do is public service. Davis Polk doesn't need you, and I will see you on weekends. And that was it. So I took the job, started 2 weeks later, and that began my real effort to do public service.
And we're so glad that you did. You mentioned having a partner in life, but one of the things that struck me in the book was your really deep friendships with other women. Some of them famous, some not. I was particularly struck with the part about Gabby Gifford. I could cry right now.
But
I can still see her coming before the joint session in the most beautiful suit. But I didn't know how she found that suit. Now I know, because I read your book.
Gabby's an amazing woman, and I talk about friendship as something really important in our lives, particularly for women when they're struggling with having a job, having a family, and I call it a three-legged stool. You've got your job, you've got your family, but the third leg that really keeps you upright is your friends, because you need someone to complain to about your husband or your kids or your job, and they have to fully understand you and not judge you, and just to have that ability to be yourself is so wonderful. And I fell in love with Gabby before I ever met her, and it was because after my first election in 2006, which we can talk about later, but it was a very grueling race, and I really had no chance of winning, but I won anyway. And CNN called the day after the election and said, we need you to be interviewed about flipping the house, and you need to come down to New York City. And the day after the election was my son's third birthday, and there was no way I was going to New York City. I was exhausted, and so I declined. But I turn on the TV, and I see, who did they get? And it was Gabby, and she's on TV saying how her election was so important, and she was so smart and so sharp, and I thought, she's going to be my colleague. I'm really excited. And then when I got to Washington, she was everything that, you know, I imagined. She was a woman who cared deeply about her constituents. She was bold. She was elected from a very Republican district like mine. And we just became two peas in the pod. And the day she was shot was the worst, worst day of my public life. I couldn't believe so much evil could enter her world. And I struggled with our friends because we didn't know what happened. We didn't know if she had died. We didn't know anything. And I just remember that moment feeling that the world was just looking at me and Jonathan as I shook and cried and couldn't understand how it could happen. But even more horrible than that was the amount of inspiration that Gabby gave us, because I watched her struggle from being in the hospital with tubes everywhere, her eye covered, to open her eyes and to tell her husband that not only could she hear everything, but she could understand everything and that she was gonna fight her way back. So she's an amazing woman, and she's now doing amazing advocacy around the country, really fighting against gun violence and being a voice for real reform, and she's amazing.
What an amazing friendship. But I love what you say about having a friends that you can just tell whatever it is you need to talk about. I think we all need that so much. But I'm particularly interested in the kid part, because I've watched my daughters and my daughter-in-laws when they get that call that one of the children is sick and you've got to go get the kid no matter what's on your agenda. I don't know how you do this. It's amazing.
Well, you know, my life is easy compared to most working moms, and that's really the point. I have enormous flexibility. If I have a sick child, I can bring Henry or Theo to work with me. If I have to cancel a meeting because of a parent conference, I can get to the school in exactly 6 minutes. So everything's in a 1 mile radius, which makes my life possible. But the women that I really worry more about are all those who don't have any flexibility. The woman who's going to clean this auditorium tomorrow, the woman who's working double shifts in the emergency room, someone who has set hours, who has no flexibility, who has no sick days. And they have the hardest time working their way out of poverty. A low-wage worker probably doesn't have a vacation day or a sick day, so if their kid's sick, they're going to miss work. If they miss work, they probably lose their job. If they don't lose their job, they certainly don't get promoted. And so when we have this debate of having it all, it's an absurdity, because most women are doing it all. Most women have to do it all. 8 out of 10 families, moms are working. 4 out of 10 families, moms are the sole or primary breadwinners. So women want and need to be providing for their children. And so we should really be talking about how do we support all families, all women, in their ability to meet the needs of their children, meet the needs of their families, and do a good job. Because that is the face of the workforce today. It is not what we imagine from the Mad Men era. It is no longer dad goes to work and mom stays at home. And so things like paid leave really could make a difference. Something as simple as affordable daycare or universal pre-K makes a difference. It's one of the reasons why raising the minimum wage and equal pay is so important. Because right now our minimum wage is poverty wages. If you have two kids, you're $3,000 below the poverty line. And if you have young kids, you can't possibly afford daycare. It's a catch-22, and it pulls these women down to the lowest wage jobs over and over and over again, which is why 2/3 of minimum wage workers are women.
And I know you're working on this, so could you tell us a little bit about what you're doing?
So one of my goals is to focus on paid leave, because we are the only industrialized country in the whole world, that doesn't have some form of paid leave. And it's constraining for all families, but more often than not women. Because when you have an ill family member, when your parent is dying, when you have a newborn, women will ramp off their careers as needed to meet those family needs, because inevitably they are the ones who will do that by choice or by necessity. and we don't accommodate it. So when that woman ramps off to work less hours or to work a different shift or to quit or to find a more flexible job, she's inevitably going back into the workforce at a lower wage with less responsibility. So even though women are graduating more than half the college degrees and more than half the advanced degrees, they're not able to reach their full potential because there's no structural supports for them. And so that's one of the things I want to create a national conversation about, because no one's doing it, and it's not on the national agenda, and it should be, because it's an artificial drag on our economy. It could create enormous economic potential if we could keep women in their jobs longer by giving them flexibility when they desperately need it.
Thank you. Every woman in this audience who has ever been to work or worked in a group has run into some sexist comments, but some of the comments you got really shocked me as I read your book. I could not believe, frankly, that someone would say this to a congresswoman or a senator or to anyone.
Yeah, happens all the time. So, because you haven't read the book, I'll share a couple. So when I was pregnant, I was the sixth woman ever to have a baby in Congress. So not many young women are members of Congress, and rarely during childbearing years. And so I was becoming very pregnant in front of my colleagues, and they didn't quite know what to do about that. And so the women's gym was closed when I was pregnant, but I was pre-diabetic. So my doctor said, you really have to work out every day because you had pre-gestational diabetes with your first, and it could be very dangerous with your second. So I did, and I went on a pre-diabetic diet and went to the gym religiously. And so I'm working out in the men's gym, and this very old male congressman, who I didn't even know, comes up to me and says, good thing you're working out, because you wouldn't want to get Porky. And I'm thinking, what a jerk. Like, I don't know you, and you are telling me this? And then there was efforts to be nice, which didn't go over well. So one of my favorite congressmen, who's Southern, one day when I'm about 7 or 8 months pregnant, is walking me down this aisle on the House floor, and he looks at me and he said, you know, Kirsten, you're even pretty when you're fat. It's like, really? I'm 8 months pregnant. Not helpful. But these comments obviously did not affect me at all. I was so far along in my career. I'd been a partner at a major New York City law firm doing multi-million dollar pieces of litigation. I'm now a congresswoman. I could care less what these men say to me. But the stories I also included were the ones when I was younger. And those are the times when those stories do affect you, when you don't know how to deal with them, when you have no tools, and you don't know how to put them into perspective. So when I was that young lawyer at Davis Polk, I remember working constantly on a case where I was working every weekend, canceled vacations, every night, just very long hours, and managing a lot of junior associates. And at the celebratory dinner for this case, the partner that I'm working for starts to raise his glass and say, well, I just want to thank Kirsten for her hard work, but don't you just love her haircut? Doesn't she look fantastic? So when a boss says that to you, you feel devalued immediately. You feel like all that hard work you put in, all of that intelligence that you put behind your work and your smarts is absolutely irrelevant, because all you're worth is how well you look that day. You could not feel more devalued in that moment. Now, I was fine, because the people in that room I'd worked with for years, they all knew me, they knew my skills, they knew my intelligence. I didn't have to prove myself to any of them. But if there was anyone in that room that I didn't know or didn't know me, it would have ruined my chances. It could have undermined my credibility across the board. And so one of the reasons why I wrote this chapter specifically on appearance is because for women in all sorts of industries, appearance becomes an issue. And in politics specifically, when opponents talk about a woman's appearance in a campaign, it undermines her. And it doesn't matter if it's positive or negative. The studies show when your looks are discussed, it undermines your credibility. And so in my first campaign, my opponent tried both tactics. The first tactic was, oh, she's just a pretty face, meaning obviously I'm too pretty and too stupid to be a member of Congress. Of course, I ignored that and just said thank you. And then the second thing he tried was the very unattractive picture. He found a picture of me from a press conference where my hair was blowing wildly, and I was angry about something, and so I have a scowl, and he puts it in his mailers, and he puts a green wash over the mailer, so I have this green face. I look like a witch, like some crazed, power-hungry woman. Interestingly, it backfired because the women of the district were so upset that he used such an ugly picture. and they were angry that he would do this to me. And so I became relevant in their minds, and they wanted to know who I was and why was I running and what did I care about. So if he had just ignored me, he would have done much better. But because he attacked me, it created a question in the mind of the voter as to who she is, why is he attacking her, and what does she stand for. So it's a reality, and I took the time to write these examples and these illustrations because I want to be able to elevate the debate so that that female reader, that young reader perhaps, can see that even if these things have happened to her, she's not alone. It doesn't define her. She can push past it, become partner, be that guy's boss, change the culture, and actually take control. And that's why it's worth having a conversation. It doesn't matter any given comment by any given jerk. What matters is that we have to recognize that women aren't being valued or that they're being undermined in the workplace in a way that's undermining to them, but also to their potential to really reach their full economic potential and opportunity. So it's a relevant debate that I thought was important to include.
Very important. You're one of my heroes, and one of the things about you, because I am involved, I have to say, so I'm prejudiced, in the group Protect Our Defenders, is the way you have stood up for the people who have been sexually attacked in our military. And it seems to be an uphill fight. But could you tell us how it's going and what's going on there?
So I in the book I talk about how sometimes issues come to you. You don't find them, they find you. And this was an example of that. I had been asked a couple of times by friends to look at this problem. They said, there's something going on in the military, you have to look at it. There's something going on about sexual assault. And the first time I looked at it, I realized there was one problem with men and women, or women who were serving abroad, and that if they wanted access to reproductive services, to abortion services specifically, in an instance of rape, they had to disclose that they were raped, and they didn't want to. And so they couldn't get basic health care. And so I addressed that. And the second thing we learned about, we realized that if someone was convicted of rape in the military, the sentence wasn't the same. There were men who were still serving who were convicted as rapists, and that made no sense. But that's all I knew. And it wasn't until the second or third time someone came to me and said, you need to watch this documentary. You need to actually understand what's going on. And so I watched the film and made my whole staff watch it with me. And it's called The Invisible War. And it is this horrific, horrific story of men and women who are brutally raped. And when they try to report those rapes, they are told, it's your own fault. I'm not going to do anything. You were the one drinking. Or a whole host of reasons why these members of our armed forces could not receive justice. And the stories were so personal and so infuriating, I determined at that moment that I was going to take this on. And then a couple of good things happened. I was offered a position to take a subcommittee chairmanship on armed services, and one of the committees that was available was the personnel subcommittee. So I grabbed it, and I said, my first hearing's on this issue, and I made sure the survivors testified first, so the generals had to listen. And that's the first time it's ever been done in the history of the Armed Services Committee. And it made a difference. Because the problem has been is no one's listening to the survivors. No one's listening to their stories. And what they will tell you over and over again is they don't trust the chain of command. That in fact, they don't believe the chain of command will do anything because they've either told them they're going to do nothing or they've watched other people do nothing in the face of these brutal rapes. And we decided that the approach should be to do exactly what they suggested, take the decision making out of the chain of command, give it to trained prosecutors who are objective. Because unfortunately, too many commanders had a bias, and the bias was close ranks around the valued soldier, the person who's done the three tours of duty. Oh, he's got a wife and two kids. He couldn't have possibly done this. But if you know anything about the crime of rape, it is a crime of aggression. It is a crime of dominance. It has nothing to do with romance. And it is often perpetrated by recidivists, people who target their victims in advance because they're vulnerable, because they're new, because their credibility can somehow be undermined. They not only give the woman a drink, they might spike her drink with a date rape drug. There's so many things that have happened. And justice isn't possible because there's no incentive to create transparency and accountability. So the last year we had records for 26,000 rapes, sexual assaults, and unwanted sexual contacts in 1 year, and only 1 in 10 reporting. The 1 in 10 brave enough to report, 62% were retaliated against because they reported. And what that looked like is they were kicked out of the military. They were blamed. They were told it's your fault. And the punishments are akin to slaps on the wrist. So we have more work to do. And interestingly about this cause, it received bipartisan support. We had Rand Paul, we had Ted Cruz, we had Chuck Grassley. We also had Barbara Boxer and Bernie Sanders. So we had the full spectrum of the Senate supporting these reforms. We only had 55. We needed to get to 60 to overcome the filibuster, but we made huge progress. And our goal is to get the 60 votes we need, and we just need more stories to be told. We need more sunlight on the issue. And in the meantime, we're taking on the sexual assault on the college campus. And interestingly, the people I didn't get for sexual assault in the military, I have for sexual assault on college campuses. So people are beginning to look at these issues for the scourges that they are and are willing to try to create some transparency and accountability.
Thank you so much for what you're doing. We have many students here who are looking to be leaders. How do people get involved? I know that how you did it, which is amazing, you were so persistent. I think I would have folded long before you did. But how do you advise people who are thinking, at any age, I'd like to get involved?
Well, the most important thing, first step, is to decide what you care most about. Because all advocacy starts with you having a sense that something's wrong or something needs to change or something that needs to be fixed. And whatever your passion is will lead you to your public service careers. So for example, if you care deeply about your child's education, you may really want to run for the school board. If you care deeply about global climate change, you may want to join a board for the Sierra Club or for League of Conservation Voters. But finding what you care about is the most important first step, because the passion that drives you on that issue is the passion that's going to drive you to be an effective advocate. And if you decide you want to run for office, that's going to be your platform. That one issue you care more about than anybody else is the thing that people are going to know about you. If you're the one who wants to end gun crime in our communities, everyone's going to know that about you, and that's going to be why they vote for you. It's also going to be why a woman will choose to run. Once she learns it's not about her, that it's entirely about the cause that she believes so strongly in, she is freed to fight hard, to ask people for support, to feel invincible, because she's fighting for that one thing she knows must change, that one thing that she believes is her reason for being there. And that's what makes the best candidates. It's what makes the best advocates.
Senator Gillibrand, you are amazing and inspiring, and I bet there's a whole group in this audience who are going to go right out and get started. In the meantime, I bet there are people with questions. Are there some questions in the audience, and do we have the wonderful students to help us? I see somebody.
Thank you for coming, Senator. My question is, if Hillary Rodham Clinton asked you to be her running mate in 2016, would you accept? And failing that, would you have the ambition to be a presidential candidate in 2020? Or if there is an incumbent President Clinton running in that year, do you have an ambition to run for president in 2024? Let's make some news. Thank you.
Well, I love my job in the Senate, and I feel like it's an amazing platform. If Hillary Clinton asked me to be her running mate, of course I would say yes. Why wouldn't you? I don't think that's going to happen, but I really do love the fact that I get to use my seat in the U.S. Senate as a way to advocate for New Yorkers, to advocate for issues of national importance, to advocate for civil liberties and social justice. So I feel like I'm very blessed. So no, I do not aspire for 2020 or 2024.
But if it happens, we can say we knew you win. Do we have another question?
Hi, I wanted to ask you about when you enter a room of other women, and how do you stay true to yourself and not feel that the women around you might be judging you or saying that, you know, like they might be bullying you, or, you know, when you got to the Senate, did you feel like you had to be friends with the women?
No, I never feel like I have to do any one particular thing, but I really wanted to be friends with the women in the Senate. So I was really grateful when a number of them reached out and gave me great advice. And in some measure, some of the more senior women took me under their wing. So, for example, I remember the greatest gift I got in my first few months was Dianne Feinstein asking me to have lunch. And I said, of course. So we go have lunch. And she said, you know, I have a state of 40 million people, and it's a very big state, and your state has 20 million people. So I imagine you'd love some advice on how to keep tabs on what's going on across your state. I said, yes, I would love that. She said, well, over the years, I've developed this technique of being able to be briefed by my staff on all these different issues. And I thought if I shared that with you, it might help you. And I'm saying, yes, yes, that would be great. And so she basically gave me a life lesson on things that took her 20 years to put together, on how to get briefed on how many phone calls, what topics, where her legislation stood, what all the different state staff were doing, what the staff in D.C. were doing. And she basically gave me a copy of her weekly briefing, which was like getting the formula for Coke or Pepsi. I was so excited. And so that was an enormous kindness that she gave to me. Senator Mikulski was the same way. She said, I'd like you to come to my office so I can tell you a little bit about how to do appropriations. And I said, oh, good. So off I go, and you know, she reveals all the best ways to be the strongest advocate for your state. So the women of the Senate are quite collegial, and they really want to work together. And so we have these quarterly dinners, with which Barbara Mikulski started 20 years ago when there were two women in the Senate. They started having caucus meetings, and she's kept them up since then. And so we get together, we have dinner, we get to know each other as women first, as mothers, as daughters, as sisters. And what it allows for is this willingness to leave partisan politics at the door and to look to how we can find common ground and get things done. And so I've really found the women of the Senate to be extraordinarily collaborative. They want to work together, and they're very good at finding common ground. So even though I might have, you know, I'm not going to agree with all of them on all things, you know, some of the more conservative senators, we have very little in common, but even with them, I find legislation to sponsor with them. And I think that's what we need much more of in Washington.
Could you say something about the inaction in Congress? I'm here. The inaction in Congress on climate change. What's your opinion of what's going on?
I think it's disgraceful because it is such an urgent crisis in our country. It is not only a national security risk, it is a risk to lives with all the enormous, dramatic, violent storms we've been getting, and wildfires and droughts throughout the country. It is a missed economic opportunity. There's so much there that frustrates me. As a New Yorker, we just went through Superstorm Sandy, and it was devastating. I mean, people lost their lives. Children died, seniors died, people who couldn't get out in time died. Businesses were gutted, destroyed, homes flattened, and these were supposed to be 100-year floods. They're every 2 years now. Things are changing. And what we're seeing is that you're not going to have enough money to fix all the destruction. You have to be much more proactive about changing this curve of global climate change. And you're only going to do it through bold leadership. We also have a crisis of national security. when we were trying to deal with Russia, it's not surprising we couldn't get Europe to do the things we wanted to do because they relied on Russia for natural gas. For America, I don't think we get the Middle East to do all the things we want them to do, whether it's Saudi Arabia or other countries, because of our still dependency on foreign oil. And we are the greatest innovators in the world. We invented solar, we invented wind, geothermal, hydropower, all of it. But because Congress doesn't focus on business and tax credits and getting things done on time, so much of our renewable energies have gone overseas. They've gone to China. And so now China's manufacturing wind energy and solar energy. And if you know anything about manufacturing, when you're building something, you are far better poised to do next generation. And so they're better poised now to innovate more than us, which is highly wasteful. We were at the forefront of these industries, and we are letting the leadership pass us by. Lost economic opportunities. So for all those reasons, it's highly disturbing that we have not had an energy plan since I've been in Congress. We have not passed an energy bill since I've been in Congress since 2006. And there is a way to do a bipartisan plan where you are going to lock in goals and production with a combination of historic carbon-based fuels with renewable fuels. But you will never get to a renewable economy if you don't create a plan over the next 20 years. And we're not creating the plan. We're not locking in the deductions. We're not locking in how we're going to treat these investments. And that's a missed opportunity for all the reasons stated. So I'm very frustrated. And I really wish it's something Congress could spend far more time doing and get the kind of consensus that's necessary to put some strong leadership on the table.
Senator, thank you for coming to this wonderful university this evening. And my question for you is that we hear so much day in and day out that can make us feel hopeless about Congress. What can you share with us from your perspective that can make us feel hopeful as we leave this room tonight?
Well, I think there's two long-term goals we should have that if we can really fight for, it will change everything in Washington. The simplest thing we should fight for is campaign finance reform and publicly funded elections. And the reason why I say that is one of the reasons why we don't have the kind of public servants that we really want is that politics is so ugly. The fact that you have unlimited spending through corporations without any disclosure distorts elections, and it becomes extremely negative, which is one of the reasons why very few women run. We still only have 20 women in the Senate. We only have 18% in the House. So if you can fight for and eventually achieve publicly funded elections, you're going to change the players list. And my long-term goal is to elect many more women to Congress. If we had 51% of women in Congress, the agenda would shift. We wouldn't spend the last two Congresses debating whether women should have access to affordable contraception. That would be a foregone conclusion. We'd be talking about global climate change or immigration reform or gun control or anything else that is important for our communities. And so what we have to do, in my opinion, and the reason why I wrote this book and created a call to action and fund women candidates across the country, is because we need to make sure our leadership reflects America. We need to reflect the diversity of this country. Because inevitably, when you have those male and female voices being heard together, it is stronger. You're going to have better outcomes, better results, a broader agenda, and different solutions. And so the hope lies, I believe, in the women of the Senate. It lies in those who will leave partisan politics at the door, find the common ground. And I believe those we have those candidates. So we just have to keep fighting politically, elect the ones who really share our values, and eventually change the players list.
Thank you so much. That was time has gone, but that last question was perfect. So I want to see all of you getting involved. You've inspired me, and I know all of us here. Thank you so much, Senator Gillibrand.
So we'll sign books out there, or where? No. Here?
Senator Gillibrand is going to sign your books. Give us about 1 minute, and we'll be coming up through this aisle. If you need more books, they have them out front, and we will make sure that all of you get to meet her and have your books signed.